Line. It is now 1 p.m.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Laura Pappano begins her latest book by pointing out that public schools are places where people from all backgrounds and circumstances have come together to learn. These schools have played an important role in American society as places for community building where everyone is welcome, and 90% of American children attend them. Public schools have been nonpartisan gathering places for over a century, but in recent years, things have changed and they've become a source of cultural and political war. The book, School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics and the Battle for Public Education, is published by Beacon Press, and it brings award-winning journalist and author Laura Pappano to our show now. Welcome. Laura.
Well, she needs to unmute.
I think you're on mute.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. It's, you know, it's the etiquette that you get used to, of always muting yourself. But thank you. I'm so excited to be here, Leonard.
Well, I'm excited to have you. This is an important book. You've written about K-12 and higher education for over 30 years. Was there something specific that led you to begin writing this book?
Well, as I say in the opening, is I didn't want to write the book. I didn't plan to write the book. But when I started hearing and seeing all that was happening around the country, that was actually not about education and a misunderstanding and a misreading of what happens in schools, I felt really compelled to talk about it because I have been in hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of classrooms over this time. And what I was hearing did not jive with, you know, what I understood.
You say well-funded and well-organized far-right actors are using our public schools as a platform to gain political power. And in what ways?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as you said at the top of the show, I mean, schools have been a place where everyone was welcome. And you, I mean, as a mom myself in public schools, as a student in public schools, I never knew what anyone's politics were. You'd be on the sidelines of games. You'd be, you know, baking goods for the, you know, teacher appreciation breakfast. And nobody asked, you know, what your political beliefs were. And what I have noticed is that that's changed. And I think it is hurting our communities. I've heard from, you know, parents who can no longer support certain activities at their schools because the quote unquote other parents are doing that. And it's a real loss to our sense of community because public schools are the place where we kind of put those things aside and really just focused on supporting our community, our children. And what has happened is that the far right has discovered what we all kind of long recognized, that public schools touch nearly everyone and that this is a wonderful vehicle, as they've discovered, to, you know, to try to gain power and gain political power by disrupting what was a kind of nonpartisan space.
How successful have they been so far?
Well, I mean, in the disrupting piece, I think rather successful. The fact that a lot of our conversations locally, nationally, you know, in school board meetings are about these kind of culture war issues is really a signal that they've successfully, you know, fed some sense of disruption. And it doesn't mean that they're accurate. In fact, most of the things that, you know, you hear are just simply not true. I mean, teachers are not trying to change the gender of your child. Libraries do not collect pornography. Hmm. So, you know, and yet it's very easy to frame these things in a kind of scary way that gets parents who may not and others who may not fully understand what happens in schools riled up and concerned. You know, and to their benefit.
Well, how different is this from concerns of the past? A headline in the 1947 issue of Ladies' Home Journal was "Our Schools Are in Danger," and a story titled "Schools in Trouble" was in the February 1971 issue of Parents Magazine.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that I've noticed is, and I found those at the Harvard libraries, and is that we have always been concerned about our public schools, but the concerns are a little bit different in that we've always worried about how well are children learning to read, how is math going, are our kids graduating, are they completing high school, what are the graduation rates? We worry too about funding. How much should property tax determine, your per pupil expending in a district? But those concerns are different than what we're hearing now. And what I'm talking about is that those concerns are about the substance of school. They're about how we carry out the task of educating each and every child and giving everyone who enters, a fair shot at a good education. Yes, there have been problems, and this is what the conversation has been about. But more recently, we're not talking about how do we help children succeed. We're talking about should we have public schools? And that's a very different conversation.
In 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. What did it mean for public education?
Well, it was a really key piece of legislation. It was the beginning, and that piece of legislation was the kind of key authorizing law that every time it's reauthorized by Congress changes its name. But the point of it was, and he said when he spoke to Congress that the goal here is that every child, no matter their wealth, their background, where they live, deserves access to a high-quality public education.
No matter how poor the family.
No matter how poor the family, where they live.
How great their handicap and color of their skin.
Exactly. That is the language. Thank you. And that, that is the great promise of public education. Have we 100% succeeded? Absolutely not. And that's the conversation that we ought to be having right now. How do we do the messy work of educating children who come from very different circumstances, very different home situations, very different abilities and needs? How do we give everyone a good public education? But that's not what we're having happen right now. Right now, we're having a battle over things that really are not about the substance that you just cited right there.
But isn't just 8% of school funding coming from federal sources? Public education is primarily a state and local responsibility. So did it really matter what Lyndon Johnson thought at the time?
Well, I think what's really important.
Or what Joe Biden thinks currently.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple layers there. Yes, public education is primarily a state and local task, especially when it comes to funding. The federal government's 8% spending, though, does come with some rules and safeguards, including protections for students with special needs and disabilities. And the Title IX regulations, which have become really quite critical in many school districts, those are all federally driven rules. So the idea that the federal government has some sway, and we've seen over the last several decades that kind of change. There was, with No Child Left Behind, much maligned now. That was the first time when there was real kind of focus on kind of testing in a kind of now many people feel excessive way. But the impetus behind it was that kind of promise of we need to make sure that everybody is getting what they need. On the other hand, what I've seen over my career is that education has gone from being about the process to about outcomes. And I think we probably have tipped too far on the outcomes end of it. But Again, that's, public schools, because they are local state enterprises, that's where the school board comes in. And that's why we've had such really intense battles at the school board level, because, school boards, do not necessarily have to be involved in all of the culture issues. And yet many are choosing to, because they are being, we have a number of cases across the country where school boards have been taken over by far right candidates, school board members who have been funded by, national and groups. And, as Steve Bannon said at CPAC 2 years ago, he said, the school board is the key that picks the lock. And what he meant and elaborated in another interview was that this is how they're going to, quote unquote, take back America, town by town, district by district. So what the revelation for the far right was, if you control the school board, you can control what happens in schools. You can control, whether or not schools even exist. So, that's what we're seeing happen, yeah, is this, this targeting of school boards, which, I mean, as someone who has covered education for a very long time, I've watched more school board meetings in the last, 18 months than I did in the first, 20X years of covering school boards, just because they have become the spaces where these things are playing out.
We'll come back to school boards in a moment, but I was wondering why you chose the title School Moms for your book. What role does gender play in this story, and don't fathers also play a role?
Oh, of course fathers play a role, but and grandparents and citizens were concerned. But I called it School Moms because what I was seeing around the country were moms who were already kind of involved in school, in some cases not involved in school, coming together because they felt compelled to push back against these far right attacks. And yes, Moms for Liberty is the other moms group that's perpetrating some of this. But I wasn't ready to kind of cede moms to Moms for Liberty, because there are so many moms who are out there on the ground every day working for schools. And they have been, and they've been largely invisible. And I think the gender piece here is that mother's labor is largely ignored or disregarded. It's in a way, it doesn't kind of factor into people's kind of visible, tangible view of kind of what counts as impactful. And yet, whether it's, organizing wrapping paper fundraisers, or school trips, or teacher appreciation breakfasts, moms are highly involved in public schools and in their children's education. And they bring a tremendous amount of expertise. And, many moms hold jobs outside the home, and many for a period of their careers may not hold jobs outside the home. And what I have long objected to is the idea that that's a blank space on people's resume. I once had a mom ask me to have coffee because she wanted to kind of re-enter the workforce after taking some time off. And I was just struck by how timid she felt about her own skills. And that stuck with me because, the moms who are organizing on the ground now, oh my gosh, networking.
You said
details.
They pay a motherhood penalty.
Yes. Well, that's a well-known kind of research piece. Is that women have this face a motherhood penalty. And Sari Kerr at Wellesley Centers for Women has done a lot of research on this that notices that, when women are out of the workforce doing child caring, that they in essence suffer in their, pay and their advancement. That catches up later on, but it's really striking to me that we don't value what women are doing. It's kind of invisible work.
My guest is Laura Papano, P-A-P-P-A-N-O. Her latest book, School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education, from Beacon Press. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. You point out that even before the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote, in some locales, women could vote and be elected to school boards. And haven't parent-teacher associations relied on mothers to organize fundraisers to pay for playground upgrades, school trips, classroom supplies, and the like?
Yes. I mean, there is a long and wonderful history of, what you're citing is back before women even did have the right to vote. There was an understanding that women's quote unquote natural role as mother gave them, in a sense, entree into having a voice around issues that involve children. And that extended to, as common schools were created, neighborhood schools, that extended to schools. And one of the wonderful things that I found when researching this was old child welfare magazines from, early 20th century, in which women sought to extend the home, not just, not only to the schools, and they sought to make schools more quote unquote home-like, but there was one very leader in Wisconsin who was very ambitious and sought to, urge women to extend the home throughout the world so that they could gain even more kind of authority and voice. But what's really striking is that women have used that expertise as mothers to have a voice. I mean, it was moms who pushed for child labor laws, who pushed for school nutrition, and immunizations. So, and if you read these old magazines from, the early 20th century, there are reports from all the states that kind of chronicle the efforts made to raise money to buy clothes because some children did not attend school because they didn't have clothes to wear. Or there is money raised for milk because children needed nutrition. So there was a whole, problematic piece in that sometimes women, some of these groups could be a little, overbearing. And also they, easily ignored the kind of challenges of, Black mothers and Selena Butler from Atlanta, who had organized, kindergartens and was speaking to conferences ahead of the White House. And that, in the South, especially the Rosenzweig schools, moms were not only kind of organizing food, they were actually having to, figure out how to build the schools and fill them with the supplies and the needs. So there has long been a kind of parallel, kind of segregated education. I think we're seeing some of that impetus kind of return now. And I think that some of these efforts, the white Christian nationalism, is about this kind of quest for segregating public education. And we can talk more about that when we talk about vouchers.
Well, you mentioned Moms for Liberty, which was founded in 2021 in Florida. They call themselves a parents' rights group, also active in New York, in fact, in Queens, in Pennsylvania and the Carolinas. They oppose critical race theory, want to restrict curriculum about Black history, the teaching of Black authors. They want to block LGBTQ-focused books and block the teaching of gender identity. So I'm assuming that school librarians have been affected by these political pressures.
Oh, absolutely. You just listed a whole host of things there, Leonard.
You could go on and go through them.
So, I mean, absolutely. I mean, we can, you know, we can talk about libraries, we can talk about the restrictions. I mean, you can take any one of those things, and you know, what you're hearing in all of that is an effort to, you know, kind of control, you know, the conversation in schools and control the, you know, who feels welcome in schools. I mean, what's, you cited at the top of the show, the fact that 90% of, you know, kids in this country go to public schools. So we need them to work. And we also have to recognize that, you know, in 1986, 70% of those public school students were white. By 2020, that figure was 47%. And by 2030, according to federal statistics, you know, projections, that's going to be 43%. So our schools look even just a few decades ago. And the fact, I mean, political or not, just on a practical level, an economic level, we need to educate everyone. We need to make everyone feel as if they belong and can, you know, and can participate in our society, because this is our future. So the idea of targeting certain students, certain ideas, is an anathema to me, especially if we're going to look at the kind of even just the straight economic and cultural future of this country.
Are there disagreements over how math or history should be taught, about evolution? Haven't some dictionaries been banned because they contain words that most of us would just find totally acceptable?
Well, I mean, I think what you're pointing out is that, you know, in some districts, in some places, school boards have sought to really try to kind of halt, cancel, eradicate anything that they don't agree with. And it's, you know, it's kind of like a whack-a-mole situation. I mean, you cannot erase people and culture. And, you know, I guess one of the things I think about is, you know, in, you know, Keller, Texas, right? So you have a far-right school board that completely changed the way books in the libraries are selected. I mean, most places, you know, librarians are extremely well-educated people. They have to do a lot of very specific training in order to do their jobs. And the, you know, the practice is that you have to curate your books to suit your community. It's not just like there's one library list that gets sent out and everybody, every school kind of just signs up and buys all the books and puts them on the shelves. Every librarian is curating and choosing books that they believe will suit their community. And what you had in, you know, in this one community, and certainly not the only place where this has happened, is you have, you know, school boards then bypassing the professionalism of librarians and deciding that, you know what, we are going to approve every single book ourselves. We're going to put it out for review for 30 days. Then we will approve every school board, every school book that goes in the library. And I was watching one school board meeting that went on for 5.5 hours. And a middle school librarian stood up and said that what you're doing is just an affront, basically, to the professionalism of librarians. And she said, and the result is that, she said, I cannot get books about squirrels or camels or football. I cannot get the latest Diary of a Wimpy Kid or Guinness Book of World Records without the express approval of the school board. The result is that children in the library are coming up to her and saying, where are all the new books? And she said, not being able to get books in a timely manner because they have to go through this Byzantine process, she said, I don't tell them why we're not getting new books in a timely manner. She said, because it's political. That is the reason why this is happening.
So it's not just...
And I think
just,
that is...
I'm sorry, finish your thought.
No, you go ahead.
But it's not just school boards. Haven't some politicians, Ron DeSantis, pushed through laws in Florida that ban the teaching of critical race theory and other things that were found objectionable?
Well, let's talk about critical race theory for a minute.
Okay.
You know, it's one of the things is that, you know, in the book, I really, you know, critical race theory is a graduate level concept used to make sense and parse how the law works with regard to race. It really has nothing to do with the history lessons that happen in K-12 schools at all. But what happened is Christopher Rufo, you know, a conservative activist, and he was very plain on Twitter. He said, we are going to take this phrase and we are going to imbue it with all kinds of negative vibes so that when people see CRT, they'll just load onto it all the things that make them upset. And he was very successful. I mean, he called it he described it as a branding exercise, and it succeeded. So now we say CRT, CRT. I honestly, when we're talking about CRT in public schools, I just have absolutely no idea what we're talking about. What is it that we can and can't say about race? And I know that legislation in Texas and a few other places in Tennessee have really worked to kind of define it as making anyone feel, any white child, any child feel uncomfortable. I mean, how can you predict or understand what's going to make someone feel uncomfortable? And why are we just worried about white kids feeling uncomfortable? What about those percentages of students of color who want to feel that they exist? I mean, my experience as an education journalist and working with students in grades 3 through 8 to run a school newspaper are that you don't learn because someone tells you to learn. You learn because you feel that you can be part of the conversation in the classroom. You feel that you matter, that you are seen, that you have something at stake. And what we're trying to do now with some of this legislation is try to somehow, quote unquote, protect the feelings of certain children when we're not even sure they feel that way.
And it's not just groups like Moms for Liberty, but also Parents Defending Education, educating against CRT, but also against the pressing for Don't Say Gay laws and asserting parental rights to gain control over the review of classroom materials. The Don't Say Gay rights laws, how would they work?
Well, see, the anti-LGBTQ, and there's so many versions of whether we're talking about Don't Say Gay or we're talking about, in Florida statewide, K-12 now, or we're talking about local school boards who are passing anti-LGBTQ policies that say that, you know, you can't have a pride flag. You can't, what you're doing is you're giving permission to people to harass students, LGBTQ plus students. And what you're doing is you're creating a very dangerous and difficult environment for those students to learn. I mean, I sat down with some students in Pennsylvania. And they said after these policies passed in their district, they would walk down the hallway between passing periods and have people shouting at them and harassing them every single period of every single day. I mean, I'm not sure how learning happens when that's going on. So I don't understand what the educational goal of trying to exclude, single out, and harass or permit harassment of certain students furthers our kind of collective goal of educating our students.
When CNN asked the Moms for Liberty chapter chair in Colorado Springs if she believed there was some kind of high-level coordinated effort to make more children trans and gay, she said there is. That's kind of outrageous, isn't it?
It's so absurd as I don't even know how to respond to that because it simply is teachers. And, you know, I have a daughter who is a school principal in Texas, And her main concern is making sure that her children in grade, you know, learn to read and to write, and that she wants all the children to feel seen, heard, and that they belong, that they matter. Because ultimately, as I just said a moment ago, education doesn't happen to you. You must engage. And if we're excluding kids, they're not engaging. The idea that there's some, you know, coordinated cabal is just the most ridiculous thing in the world. And, you know, I know that we hear, and we'll hear probably even more about it, you know, during this legislative session across the country, but parental rights or parents' rights. The flag of parents' rights is just a distraction, because parents have always had rights. And parents, and forget about rights, what about influence? Parents have profound influence over their children. The idea that we need parental rights laws in our states in order to ensure that parents have, you know, can, you know, be in charge of the upbringing of their children is absolutely absurd.
Obviously, my parents' views influence the way I see the world.
Absolutely. I mean, and I guess here's a case in point is I did a story for the Hechinger Report and Vanity Fair in North Idaho. And on election day, just a few months ago, I was in Priest River and I sat down with a dad of eight. And his Facebook profile has an American flag and the Second Amendment behind him. And yet we sat in this coffee shop, you know, across from the junior high. And he said, the idea that teachers are indoctrinating my children, he said, is paranoid bull honky. He said, as a parent, I'm very involved in my children's lives and education. He builds pole barns and he wakes up and starts his day at 4:35 a.m. so that by afternoon, he can attend his children's sports practices. And he said, if my kids come home with something that I don't agree with or they don't understand, or he said, we talk about it. He said, the idea that there's not going to be stuff that I disagree with. Of course, there's going to be things that I disagree with, but that doesn't mean we can't have a conversation. And it also doesn't mean that I'm not more involved in their thinking and they're growing than teachers. And, you know, he said, it's absolutely absurd. He said, it's my job as a parent to kind of be involved in that. It's not, you know, he said, this is how the world works.
You're listening to Leonard Lopit at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Laura Papano. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of her book, School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. Just go online to give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950 during today's show, and we'll be happy to send you a copy. That's give and the number 2WBAI.org or 212-209-2950. But don't forget to make that $50 donation in the name of Leonard Lopit at Large, and we thank you very much. And return now to Laura Papano. Her book, School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education, is from Beacon Press. She's a writer in residence at Wellesley, and she has written about education for newspapers and written three other books as well. Have I left anything out?
No, Leonard. I think that's probably more than I deserve.
Well, the Moms for Liberty held a town hall on New York's Upper East Side last Thursday. And according to the education publication Chalkbeat, protesters at the event may have outnumbered the participants. They were carrying signs reading, "Mom Against Fascism, Queer People Have Kids Too, and Read Banned Books." So the fight is affecting public education in New York City as well.
I saw some clips of that. Yes, it was quite a prodigious protest. And I think you're seeing that in a lot of places. I mean, but I went to both Moms for Liberty summits so far, the first one in Tampa in June of 2022. And I was in Philly for the Moms for Liberty summit in July. And there were quite a lot of protests in Philly, as one would expect. And, you know, and I spent time talking with protesters as well as attending, you know, all of the Moms for Liberty events. I mean, you pointed out earlier, they're not the only group. They've been a very visible group, but there are groups around the country who have kind of picked up their arguments and their language. And that's the one thing that they have. You know, they've created a kind of a lexicon for talking about, you know, their objections, which resonate with some parents and some parents who just buy into the whole, you know, bit of misinformation. But parents, I think, are wising up. I mean, what's interesting is that it did take a while. They kind of got a head start. I was speaking with Liz Mkhitaryan, who founded Stop Moms for Liberty in Brevard County, which is where Moms for Liberty first started. And she said at first, and she's a, you know, veteran teacher, I think 24, 26 years as a teacher. And she said, at first she said, we didn't take their, you know, accusations and their charges, you know, seriously because they were just so absurd.
Well, they were affiliated with groups like the Proud Boys.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, they're extremists. And that's another thing I want to point out, while you brought it up, is that there is nothing wrong with conservative values. There's nothing wrong with Republicans. In fact, many, you know, people in my book are Republicans. But the challenge is with the far right and extremists. And that's what we're seeing in Moms for Liberty is an extremist group, and they are connected to other extremist group, and they are seeking to really wreak havoc on public schools. And to the credit of a lot of other moms and people like Liz Mkhitaryan, Red Wine and Blue, you know, out of Ohio, and groups on the ground like in Bucks County, Advocates for Inclusive Education. There are groups all over the country of moms who have, you know, organized and pushed back. And I think, you know, what you saw with the protest, you know, at the Moms for Liberty conference in Philly, and you saw last Thursday in New York, is parents saying kind of enough of this harassment, because it's just it is so painful to watch, you know,
No, finish your thought.
No, I said it's painful to watch the impact this has on children who are trying to participate in the life of school, because school is not just the curriculum. It's not just what books are in the library. School is about the experience of school. And moms, the far right, are poisoning that school experience. And that makes me so frustrated.
But this is not just far right. Establishment Republicans, Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley have all spoken at Moms for Liberty events. And there's a Moms for Liberty chapter in Queens, New York.
Well, I would argue that Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis and, you know, and Nikki Haley to some degree have, you know, they were all at the Moms for Liberty summit in Philly. They are the far right. They are espousing extremist views when it comes to public schools and public education. And I don't know, you know, whether it's because politically they think that it, you know, has traction. I think it initially got a lot of traction, especially after, you know, kind of mid-pandemic and right after, because a lot of people were just frustrated and angry. And I think the Moms for Liberty and other far right organization extremists gave them, you know, seized on that as a political tool, because it'll enable them to, you know, channel people's frustration and gain political power. But I think that what we're seeing now is people are saying, wait a minute, this is, first of all, this is not happening in schools. This is made up. And the result is that it's affecting and hurting our public education system. It is making wreaking havoc on librarians and libraries, on teachers. I mean, it is a very stressful thing in some of these districts to be a teacher who is trying to teach when you have the specter of attack. And it really changes the job that you're doing. Your job, most teachers are really only concerned about teaching the children in front of them and supporting them as they learn.
Wasn't there a move to slash the budget of the Croydon School Board of New Hampshire by 50%? What happened there?
Yes, it was more. So the Croydon, New Hampshire is a really lovely story. And I went up there, and what happened is, you know, it's a very small district, as many rural districts in places are. And on a snowy, they have town meeting, which means, you know, I kind of said it's like a kind of rugby scrum politically, but you go and resolutions get passed. And on one snowy day a couple of years ago, one of the, you know, far right Free Staters stood up and made a motion to slash the school budget by over half, which would have basically ended public education in the district, because the school, it's a K-5 school, and after that grade you go to you know other choices. But it would have ended this kind of school that is one of the oldest schoolhouses, you know, in the country. And it was, because it was a snowy day, you know, many people didn't make it. And, you know, and so you have what you have in school board elections a lot when far right people are elected to the board, which is the people who voted. And there was some reporting that people were confused about what the vote was. But they voted and slashed the budget, and everyone was in shock. And then parents who, you know, in Croydon, as in many other districts around the country, people had gotten used to the idea that other people would show up and vote, and that they didn't really need to be there. Well, these, you know, parents and, you know, citizens got together and started organizing and got enough signatures in order to put a revote on their local town ballot in May. And it took this kind of powerful organizing effort to do that. And I was up visiting them after they had just succeeded in restoring the budget. And what was interesting is it was the parents who organized were across all political, you know, across the political spectrum. It wasn't, you know, all one kind of political party or another. In fact, I didn't even know what political party, and some of them didn't know what other political parties their colleagues were from. But what they all believed in was that the children in their community deserved a public school. Wow. And one of Ed Stryker, Spiker, he was just an incredible, he worked three jobs, painting contractor, putting a paraplegic man to bed every night, doing work, you know, on his own as well. And he started showing up to video the meetings or stream them online. And he did that because he realized that not everybody was coming to every meeting. So he made it his job to really be involved in letting people know what was happening at all the meetings. And, you know, he's an incredibly kind man. And I went to actually the home of Hope Damon, who then ran for and won and is now serving in the New Hampshire legislature. So this motivated people's involvement in a really powerful way. But Ed showed up and he sat down, and it was outside in the summertime and at a picnic table. And he put in front of me a jar of homemade strawberry peach jam, you know, which is just such, and it reminded me of all the times when I was growing up where, you know, we would be picking fruit and then my mother would be sending me to the neighbor's house to give them jams. And, you know, and yet Ed, you know, was a, you know, is a diehard Second Amendment guy. And at the end of our time there, he lifts up the side of his black t-shirt to reveal that he has a firearm. And I, you know, being the journalist I am, I said, oh, is that, you know, is that concealed carry? Because I wanted to know, you know, do you have a concealed carry permit? But I did forget that I was in New Hampshire. He said, no, ma'am. He said, that's constitutional carry. And it was a reminder to me that we, you know, one, don't judge people, but two, that public schools touch a very wide swath of people from different backgrounds and different experiences, and they matter to people. And Ed is somebody that I've, you know, I, you know, message back and forth with, and he ran for office in town and still holds office. So I give him credit for being so involved in, and others, many of the others who helped organize that revote now hold office in the community. And of course, Hope Damon in the state legislature.
I wanted to bring up in the short time we still have left, the work of Wellesley Centers for Women's Peggy McIntosh and the SEED Project. Can you talk about how they shape your thinking about this topic?
Well, I mean, I've been involved with Wellesley Centers for Women for a very long time. And Peggy is someone who I have long admired and been on panels with. And she is just such a beautiful, you know, welcoming and calm presence. And I visited her. I mean, so for people who don't know who Peggy McIntosh is, she is the one who authored that, Unpacking the Knapsack of White Privilege. And the whole idea for the essay, which, is on the SEED website, I believe,
came because she's White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack.
Knapsack, yes, yes. And she, it came about because she was doing some work around gender, and in which she would have professors kind of come for workshops, and many of the male professors, and this was, you know, several decades ago, and they would be talking about, you know, how can we incorporate more women's scholarship into courses and et cetera. And through those conversations, you know, when people were all in the room together, everyone would say, yes, 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 what a great idea. And then she said they would go away and come back. And she would discover that, you know, no changes had been made. And it made her wonder, she goes, they seem like very nice men. You know, what's going on here? And then it made her think, well, when we're working with, you know, Black women, with women of color, they must feel the same way about us as white people, as white women. And she started exploring the idea that not just that because of your skin color, because of your race, that you were at a disadvantage, but she rather looked at the fact that because of her whiteness, that she had some invisible advantages that she received every single day, but was not necessarily aware of, whether it was, you know, because you were, you know, if you were pulled over by a police officer, if you were, you know, she knew that it wasn't because she was white. And she has a whole, she listed this, I think there are 24 of them. She made a whole list of the things that, of things that she perceived were a form of privilege in her own life.
I want to point out in the last minute we have that a survey by USA Today Ipsos last March found 72% of Americans in support of teaching the ongoing effects of slavery and racism in the United States in public schools. So this right-wing attack is not really affecting public attitudes, but it does have an effect on school boards and the like. Is that fair to say? You have a minute and a half.
A minute and a half. Wow. So, I mean, it public attitudes really do support, you know, precisely what you found, that the teaching and the inclusion of books and acceptance. But for some reason, the school board, and it's not some mystery, school boards, we have to pay attention to, because a lot of these far right school boards get elected because of low voter turnout. In some races in Texas that I looked at, there's voter turnout of 10%. So with very little effort and a lot of outside money in some cases that heightens name recognition, if we're not careful, you can see your school board turned into a far right, you know, engine of, you know, the kind of exclusion that you may be very opposed to and that most Americans are.
I've been speaking with Laura Papano. Her latest book, School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education, is published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Well, Leonard, thank you so much for having me. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate it.
And I'm sad to say that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Kate Gwan Allison for her invaluable work in preparing this segment. If you're discovering this program and would like to hear more about one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access them streaming on demand at WBAI.org. Our podcasts are available on iTunes, Apple, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@WBAI.org. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep the station coming to you during these rough economic times. We're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by calling 212-209-2950 or by going online to give2wbai.org right now. That's 212-209-2950 or give and the number 2wbai.org, because we need your help to keep bringing you this unique, in-depth content, information you usually don't get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate right now can receive a copy of the book we've been discussing, School Moms, by Laura Papano. So why not make that call right now, 212-209-2950, or go online to give to WBAI.org. And you might also consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy. You can do that for $5, $10, $15, $20 a month, whatever's comfortable for you. Some people are up to $100 or more. And you can do it as long as you wish. And it allows BAI to plan for the future, and we'll say thank you with a BAI tote bag to anyone who signs up to become a BAI buddy for $10 a month or more. But either way, I hope you'll call right now, because BAI relies 100% on listener donations, and that allows us to be completely free speech radio. There are other shows on the station that have different, we would probably disagree with what you've just heard, but that's part of what free speech radio is all about. And if Leonard Lopate at Large is part of your daily routine, and why not keep it going for someone else who is just discovering it. Again, the number, 212-209-2950, or go online to give to WBAI.org to help support independent radio. It's tax deductible. And from all of the people at this show and from all of the people at the station, we thank you if you do.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, January 24th. Here are some headlines. Humanity is as close to global catastrophe as it's ever been for the second year in a row, according to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. The group revealed its doomsday clock forecast for 2024, keeping it at 90 seconds to midnight as a result of different dangers that they say pose existential threats to humanity. According to the people who run the clock, those threats include wars in the Middle East and Ukraine, a spiraling climate crisis, and the rise of artificial intelligence. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists founded the Doomsday Clock in 1945 as a metaphor for how close humans are to destroying the world and to bring visibility to the different human-made crises that could cause that to happen. In political news, former President Donald Trump won New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation presidential primary yesterday, beating former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. At an election night party, Haley congratulated him on his victory, but insisted she did not intend to drop out of the race as she prepares for a primary in her home state of South Carolina next month. Trump's victory wasn't nearly as sweeping as his Iowa win last week, but it was never expected to be in a state with an electorate packed with moderate Republicans and independents. On the Democratic side, President Joe Biden won the primary as a write-in candidate. Biden, who is all but guaranteed to be his party's nominee, didn't appear on the primary ballot following an internal party dispute over the primary date. Fighting has intensified around the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, where aid groups warned that thousands of civilians were trapped in hospitals or struggling to flee the area. Israel has issued new evacuation orders to over 500,000 Palestinians in Khan Yunis, where many had sought refuge from Israel's attack in the northern Gaza Strip. On Tuesday, at least 9 Palestinians died when a missile hit one of the UN's largest shelters in Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, an Israeli government spokesperson ruled out a Gaza ceasefire today, despite reports that negotiations on hostage releases were progressing and repeated international calls for Israel to cease its bombardment of the Gaza Strip. At least 25,700 Palestinians have been killed and 63,000 injured in Israeli strikes on Gaza since October 7th, the Gaza Health Ministry said in a statement today. In related news, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned yesterday that Netanyahu's apparent rejection of a two-state solution will indefinitely prolong the war. In his strongest language yet, Guterres told a ministerial meeting of the UN Security Council that, quote, the right of the Palestinian people to build their own fully independent state must be recognized by all, and a refusal to accept the two-state solution by any party must be firmly rejected, close quote. He also warned that the risks of regional escalation of the war are now becoming a reality, referring to Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Pakistan. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 46 degrees and cloudy, with temperatures forecast to rise to 70 degrees by Friday. From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
The previous program was Leonard Lopate at Large, heard weekdays at 1 p.m. here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.